Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames. And it is a fine organization. Being part of Community Radio is a good part of the community. And like I said before, we are glad you are with us today. Well, just stick around a little while in Iowa, and the weather will change. We've had hot, we've had cold, and now I've got my sweater on. Here we in Iowa, we do watch the weather.
Yeah, well, we have a new element now. Every day I have to look at the air quality for the smoke particles, which is not particularly good today.
There you go. There you go. So we'll try to keep you up on all of that sort of stuff. Also, I want to do a little bit of a early September garden report. Despite the fact we haven't had rain in I don't know how long, my garden is way too busy. I am almost reaching my limit on what to do with all the stuff. I'm up to my eyeballs in tomatoes and okra and peppers and beans and this has been my best year for zucchini, Donna, and I know how much you like zucchini.
My favorite vegetable. Not.
Well, see, I actually did something that Donna ate that had zucchini in it this week, and she knew it, too. But if you make a chocolate zucchini cake, anybody will eat
it. Right. It had enough chocolate that you didn't, you know.
And there was actually quite a lot of zucchini in there.
I mean, that's my... There's no flavor to dislike in zucchini. It's not that I dislike it. It's just has so little flavor.
Oh, you expect to be stimulated by your vegetables.
But of course.
Oh, well, good. Well, good. Well, today on the Donalana Kitchen, we're going to look at how we understand our food supply. We've learned a lot of things over the years. We now have organic standards. We worry about nutrition and food additives. What have we learned? It used to be that just anything that the food industry told us was new and improved, or it had a new plastic container on it. That used to be a good thing, but then we got smarter. Yeah, we did.
Well, maybe. Yeah, there's been more research and, you know, Who knows? You can kind of pick and choose your research to suit whatever you want to eat.
Well, we'd like to encourage food literacy here on the Donalana Kitchen.
Yes.
At least know what you are putting in your body and find out as much as you can. Joining us at our kitchen table today is Kate Gilbert. Welcome, Kate.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, good. Kate is in the food science department at ISU, and she's an associate professor of teaching in the food service department.
Food science.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, there is a whole food service department there, too. So there's a lot going on over on that agricultural campus.
Yeah, but food science,
so,
see?
Kate is an expert. Here we have the expert to tell us these things.
So what do you do as part of your job? Who do you teach?
Well, I teach a variety of classes at Iowa State, from the beginning food preparation classes, the professional development class. So how do you decide what you want to do with your life after you get a degree? I teach the ingredient functionality class for seniors.
So. Ingredient functionality.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
There's many reasons I ended up in food science. And from a fairly early age, I can remember pushing a chair up to the countertop, helping my mom make things and being like, what's the flour in there for? Why is there salt?
Oh, well, good.
So my poor mother. But I think that
I think your mother did a very good job.
Absolutely, she did. But I asked a lot of questions along the way. And a product development class. So how do you get new food products to show up on the grocery store shelves?
Ooh.
In terms of making, formulating the products or marketing the products?
All of the above. So formulating, what would it look like with processing equipment to make it? So it's not just handmade. How would you do it on a larger scale? How would you make it safely and consistently?
So are you teaching all these kids how to make more ultra processed food?
I am teaching them the process, what they decide to make with it.
Oops, sorry.
They have to have consumer data, so they have to understand what consumers want. They have to look at cost. They have to look at feasibility. They have to look at nutrition. So all of that comes into play.
Yes, it is sort of like being a chef on steroids.
Wow.
You're really working with really big equipment that does all kinds of crazy, you know, smashing, extruding, blah.
Equipment on any scale is fun. If you like kitchen gadgets or if you like kitchen appliances, you will still like larger equipment. It's still fun to play with.
Yeah, all right.
Have there been any memorable ideas that have come out of the classes?
Oh, golly. Yes, some have worked and some haven't.
All right, tell us the worst, most ridiculous one.
I will not do that. Oh! That's not how this works.
I just asked for a memorable one, so you can just pick a one or two.
You know, it's fun for them to watch trends on social media and figure out if it is feasible for a larger scale. Mm-hmm. So there was a frozen honey trend during early on in the pandemic, the lockdown. And so one of the groups made like a fruit icy cup that had frozen honey layers. And that was fun to see how they translated, I think, a TikTok trend into something that could be made on a larger scale.
Yes, well, anything on TikTok is happening.
No.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. And you can count how happening it is.
Oh, wow.
Quantifiable happening. That's a marketing dream, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, we like numbers.
Well, actually, it sounds rather fun. Like you said, gadgets and gizmos and food. There's tasting in there, too, I hope.
Yes, lots of sensory tasting to make sure that consumers like the idea, that the flavor and texture and appearance are ideal, or that would consumers would approve. So, yeah, lots of research put into it, but some creativity as well.
And this is what used to be called home economics.
Yes.
Kinda.
Yes. I mean, food science came out of both kind of the home ec side of things and the agriculture side of things. But if you look at where food science originated, it was to make sure canning was safe at home and people didn't die from botulism. So, I mean, that's your origin story for food science.
Oh, well, that was a good start.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very scientific. Yes.
Very good. Well, what other things are you involved in? You are involved in something called the Iowa Food Systems Coalition.
Yes. So this one's been fun to be a part of, and I'm always very happy to be a participant and not a leader in things, especially when you have wonderful leadership. So, I think I was on some of the first calls trying to think what was going to happen, and then I fell off because life got busy, and came back on about a year ago, to see where I could contribute. But I really like the Food System Coalition. Jan Libby is organizing it. I think I've heard from Jan.
We've had Jan on the show, and really Jan is into process, people process, thinking process, and which is good in this instance because the food system is super complex.
Yes, super complex. She is such a wonderful listener, collaborator, organizer. She describes herself as a weaver, which I think is the best way to describe the Food System Coalition and the goal, is that there are so many things happening in this
Lots
space.
Lots of threads, yeah.
Yes, and it is not that you want to get in the way of any of those things that are happening, but how do we weave them together?
Well, yeah, and the things that we are the farmers and what they're growing, then how does it get from the farmer's field into a box that's clean and appropriate to go to either some distributor or some consumer, and how it's moved or even around the state, which is still local. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this goes back to a historical perspective of many, many years ago, at the early last century, all kinds of vegetables and fruits were grown all over Iowa, and we had many kinds of, you know, like one community had the squash canning mm-hmm. company, and another, lots of those things, and those are gone.
Yep.
So we want to build that back.
Yes, we want to, you know, and maybe it looks different the next time around, but we definitely want to take what we've learned from the past and move it forward. I like the coalition because it's not just farmers. It's not just healthcare. It's not just food pantries, but it's all of these pieces together.
And school yes. lunches and institutional food and retail food and
yep.
everybody at the table.
Yeah. And not that that hasn't been tried before, but this time around, it's active engagement from all of these different organizations. I was fascinated by some of the organizations. I didn't even realize what they were doing in the
mm-hmm,
state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a hopefully the next step in thinking through what we want to see in Iowa.
And some of this is possible because the USDA on the federal level is funding a lot of these initiatives all over the country, because during the pandemic, everybody kind of realized, oopsie, we could be without food in lots of parts of the country because it's coming, you know, from either all the way across the country or internationally. Or so part of this push to make us more resilient in many ways in this country mm-hmm. is being focused on the food system, because, you know, people who run out of food are not very happy.
No. No, absolutely not. Resiliency, I think, is the key when we're talking about systems. And what we saw early on in the pandemic was that we had what people would call an efficient food system, but not a resilient food system.
I love that distinction. I think that's really important.
We have taken out so many nodes in the system because we want everything to be bigger and better. But what happens when you have decreased your redundancy in the systems mm-hmm. is that if one little thing goes wrong, it just, you know, domino effects its way down. And that's why we saw so many food shortages, so many issues on getting containers off of ships in,
yeah.
you know, the docks in California.
Well, I remember the two big panics I remember are baby formula, mm-hmm. big thing. And, well, this isn't food, but toilet paper was a
yes.
scare there for
yeah.
a while. And it's amazing. Talk about something that hits people close to home.
Yes.
And that it is a health care, food care, people care thing.
Flour?
And thinking, yeah.
Flour was an issue.
And
yeah.
flour.
Yeah. Yeast. You,
yeast.
Yeah,
oh,
buy,
yeah.
Yeah. Looking for yeast on the Bach market during the early parts of the pandemic. Right.
There we go. So it's time to think about that sort of thing. And people in the Iowa Food Systems Coalition are working on it. You're also involved with not just getting things to grocery stores, and I think of community-supported agriculture, people mm-hmm. buying directly from the farmer, but there are a lot of institutional buyers that should be aware of local things, too.
Yes, absolutely. The work with food hubs in the state have been really interesting to see the progression over
Wouldn't
time.
Define what a food hub
yes.
is here in Iowa.
So you could go direct. So a farmer produces a certain amount of vegetable and goes directly to the grocery store or a restaurant, etc. A lot of times it's hard for one farmer to have all the amount all the time that a restaurant or a grocery store or
right. And he also doesn't always want to get in his truck and drive all the way to wherever it's supposed to go. And the place receiving it, whether it's like a hospital or a restaurant, they don't want five farmers pulling in with one with carrots, one with onions,
yeah.
one with, you know.
So they
can't deal with that either.
The food hub is really the answer to that
distribution
issue.
Is what it is.
So
okay.
being able to help with distribution, but also being that hub. So where all the food comes in and then can be redistributed back out. I think the food hub working group, what I've heard from that is they are learning, improving, and making a system that really doesn't have very much money to make work, figuring out how to make it work. But that's really impressive as we think through food systems and where we want to go.
Yeah, it's an expensive part of it. Like if you look at conventional produce, let's take, for example, the Lofredo company, which mm-hmm. is a big, big, produce, outlet in, it's wholesale, in Des Moines. I mean, you got to have expensive refrigeration. You got to have trucks to deliver. You've got to have docking situations to bring it in. And then you got to have the paperwork and computer systems to keep track of all of it because food is perishable.
Yes. Yes. And not all fruit and vegetable like to be held at the same temperature or treated the same way.
And dairy and,
yeah,
all
eggs
these.
And meat. Yeah. It gets complicated really quickly.
Ha. Oh, goodness. Lots of things to consider, and I'm glad the Iowa Food Systems Coalition is starting to get a handle on it. Thanks for your work on that. Anything else to say about that group?
Well, one of the big things that's happening is that we are having a booth at the local food fest at Iowa State on September 20th. It's on Central Campus, so if you know where Curtis Hall is, it'll be just right outside on the grassy area off the sidewalk. And it's from 9:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. on September 20th. That's a Wednesday.
Is that the public? It's not just for students?
Okay. It's targeted towards campus folks, but anyone is welcome to attend. And really the idea is to push and talk about local food.
Is this sponsored by your department?
No. Our department will have a booth, and a challenge to eat locally. It's put on by,
Food service?
No.
Okay.
I'm going to look that one
what
up.
Department would think of these things?
It's part of the local food initiative on campus that's putting it together.
Okay.
And I should know the name of that group, and I don't.
Well, good. Anyway, September 20th on campus. Find out about local food. As a farmer who's been doing farmers markets for quite a while, where food comes from is not that strange to me, actually. I sort of know, but I am surprised what people don't know and what people don't eat, what people don't know they can eat. So this ought to be good. This ought to be good because when people come up to you at a booth and you've got some food there or some information about food, you'll get some interesting questions.
Yes, definitely.
Well, what are you doing at your booth?
Yes, so we've got a couple different posters that we're hoping to grab some attention, and we've got a cookie, because when you want to disseminate information, a cookie is a good way to go.
Yeah. Amen. So, Kate has brought some cookies with her, and we're going to do our on-air tasting. Here we go.
Yes, so we're calling this the Iowa A to Z cookie.
A to Z.
Mm. Yes, and that's apples to zucchini. So I know you just said you
love zucchini. Oh, it's got zucchini in it. Oh, Lonnie's going to love them. Okay.
So the idea was trying to get an ingredient from a variety of different food groups that we raise here in the state of Iowa. So apples, obviously, is your A. Oatmeal and oat flour. And that's one that we probably don't talk about enough, but we have quite a bit of oat production here in the state, more historically than what we do now. It's difficult to raise food-grade oats because it's not often cold enough, essentially.
And we've lost varieties that work better here.
Well, yeah. There's a mix of things.
Yeah, there's breeding going on.
Yeah, oat genetics and oat work has never left university setting, which means compared to corn and soybeans, how far those have changed over time, oats are behind. But we have the ability, and we have a ton of oat processing here in the state. So grain millers up in St. Ansgar would count as wonderful.
Right, and oats, instead of just corn and soy, oats give you a third rotation, which is really good for the soil. It's really good for pest control. In organic systems, you have to have three rotations at least. So this is good.
Yeah, so, and I have kept it gluten-free just to try to make it to as many different pieces
as
possible.
Oh, gluten-free. Okay,
That's part of the oat flour along with the oats. Certainly there could be wheat there as well, but I was trying to kind of keep it simple on an ingredient for each food system. Honey for sweetener, because that's something that we have here in Iowa. Butter for dairy. Eggs. And then zucchini, because we needed a Z, obviously, in there, and we needed a vegetable. And I've got an idea of what to do with some of your extra zucchini now as I get ready to make these cookies.
All right. I have to say, okay, you look at the cookies in the box. They look like cookies, kind of like oatmeal cookies, but they're not crisp.
No, they're more like a breakfast cookie.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
But it was already a mouthful to say Iowa A to Z cookie, and I couldn't quite fit in Iowa A to Z breakfast cookie. So you're going to just be surprised when you eat them.
Yeah, yeah. I was surprised. You fooled me.
Yes.
The flavor is very nice.
Okay.
It's that zucchini. It'll do it every time. It's such a flavor enhancer. Oh, boy.
Yay, zucchini. Obviously, it has a few ingredients that aren't Iowa, but it's hard when you need a little vanilla
baking
and cinnamon.
Powder, right?
Yeah, baking powder, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And we are not covering meat, so the question was, could this cookie handle bacon? And I think maybe, but I just wasn't that far along in the process.
Everything can handle bacon, you know. Especially you're talking a breakfast cookie, right?
Yeah. So anyway, that could be the next addition.
Well, good. So look
Does it have
that
cinnamon in
there.
It?
That's
yes.
good.
Mm. Yeah.
And you also have information about another thing to consider is how far our food travels.
Yes. So that's one of our posters that we're hoping to grab attention. And one of the things that I think a lot of Iowans don't know is that 90% of the food we eat in this state is imported.
Really?
We have some of the
imported from not another country necessarily, but from
other
outside of the state.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we have some of the best soil in the country, of some of the best growing environments, and we are importing the vast majority of what we eat.
And because what we grow here is not really edible.
Well, it's complicated, but certainly farm acres have been pushed towards what the commodities and the farm bill supports.
You know, but Wes Jackson used to show this, what he was pointing out, that to grow all the fruits and vegetables that we need requires basically only 12% of our growing land. And the rest is like cereal crops and stuff like that, which is mostly what we... So if we even gave 12% of Iowa's farmland towards fruit and vegetable production, we could do it.
And I think it may even be less than that.
Because we have such good soil.
Well, you know, we have to consider growing conditions. We have to consider how long fruits and vegetables last. There's, you know, some things that we need to look at in terms of preservation to get longer life out of fruits and vegetables that we grow in the state. But Dave Swenson...
Yeah, season extension.
Yeah, Dave Swenson, when he was at Iowa State in the Department of Economics, did this wonderful study supported by the Leopold Center where he was looking at modeling and essentially how many acres it would take. And the national average, I have these numbers written down, 9.3 acres of vegetable production for every 1,000 people and 6.4 acres per every 1,000 people for non-citrus fruit. We take out citrus because we can't grow that here.
No.
That's just, we're always going to have to get
for
that.
For 1,000 people?
Yes.
Well, that's hard to believe. But okay.
I know. And that might be from average of acres in California where they can have multiple crops per year.
Uh-huh.
So even if we increase that some, if you talk about farm acres in the state of Iowa and how many we would need for fruits and vegetables to feed everyone, it ends up being like 0.2% of the farmland.
Yeah.
And even if we're less efficient, we're still talking about maybe 1%.
And yes, we, and also more and more we have people that are doing things on small acreage, doing vegetables and fruits, and actually small scale meat production too. But we're learning how to do that. It's so exciting.
Well, you know, we're lucky that in Iowa here, we do have the soil fertility.
Mm-hmm.
We do mostly have the moisture.
Wow.
And these are big barriers many, many, many places in the world. You know, we have to deal with, you know, we're not Florida. We have different seasons for different things, but we can do this.
We don't have hurricanes. That's good.
No, but we have tornadoes.
We haven't had one in a while. I guess we're
Don't
due.
Say that.
Okay. Got it. Anyway. Oh, why don't I take a little break here and remind all the good people out there. This is KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donalena Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was a tune called Single Foot and Horse. I think it has something to do with a horse that's a little gimpy, perhaps. Ah. But we'll make it. We'll make it. But it's by the Barn Owl Band. We're talking to Kate Gilbert about where we are in our food literacy. What do we know and what are we doing to improve our access to good food?
So Kate, you used this phrase, high quality food. Now, that is very subjective. Like, I used to have clients that say, oh, I eat healthy food, right? Mm-hmm. And I would have to sit down and really ask them detailed questions, because it means different things to different people.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, don't say high quality like that. Say high quality foods.
Okay.
Normal high quality foods.
Okay.
That was my phrasing, and I think it's come a little bit out of conversations around what sort of food system do we want to see in the state? And so my definition is maybe longer than it needs to be, but thinking through how the food was raised. So was it raised sustainably, resilient farm sort of characteristics? Was their labor adequately compensated for their work? Does it have nutritional value? Can it be connected to the people who need the food? So it's all of those things wrapped into one when you're thinking about what I would call high quality food.
We forgot to mention that Kate grew up on a farm.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So
and her family is still actively farming, and the Gilberts do a lot of very interesting agricultural experimentation. And, you make it a lot of high quality food there on your father's farm.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, it's a century farm plus multiple generations are on the farm now. And we'll talk a little bit about, what we've learned over time and where we're going. But that ability to experiment and continually find what works, what's beneficial, is a key piece to making improvements in agriculture and food systems here in the state.
All right. Well, we can say that high quality food is definitely not ultra processed food.
Probably not.
Okay.
Unless you're going to send it up in the space shuttle or something. Maybe they need things that are high processed. I don't know.
I think they're learning to
not get sick when you're in space. No. So that's really important.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Well, Kate comes to us from Iowa State University. And also she's a lot younger than us. So I want to ask a question here. What do students eat nowadays?
It's a fantastic question. I've spent almost 10 years trying to answer that question. But I think it's really interesting to think about when we're thinking through the future of food systems, because each generation takes some of the knowledge and experience from their parents and adapts it to themselves. And so
the adaption is the key word there.
Yeah. And everyone does that slightly differently.
Mm-hmm.
We know that over time, on average, we've lost knowledge and ability. We also know that
in terms of food
preparation, where food comes from, kind of food knowledge in general.
We're getting dumb and dumber.
Yeah. Or more striated in the population.
Mm-hmm.
Some know a ton and others know very, very little. We know that food time, so the time that you spent preparing food, buying food, all that kind of around there has gone down over time, just with so many other ways that you can get pulled to use your time. So food that is convenient, food that is quick to make, is going to be really popular with college age students, because they are short on time. They may not have full kitchens wherever they're at. And so that really focuses what they eat. And then the other thing is cheap. It better be cheap if you are a college age student.
Well, and readily available.
Yes.
I mean, like, there's no big supermarket in the middle of campus.
No. We're pretty lucky here in Ames that Cyride will get you where you want to go. But if you're looking just what you can get at a C-store, it's going to be different than if you're going to a full grocery store.
And we remember, students are coming from mom and dad's kitchen. Now, not mom and dad may have not been big cooks anyway, but there was probably always something in the refrigerator.
It just appeared there.
And learning how to feed yourself is actually a big part of growing up.
It's a skill set.
This is a skill set. There is something called the LFPA. What is that?
Yes. So this has been one of the best programs that has come out of pandemic learning. So going back to resiliency and understanding food systems and who needs food and how do we get it there. The LFPA.
What does that stand for?
Yes. Let me find it so I don't say it wrong. It is the Local Food Purchase Assistance Program.
Okay. This is a USDA funded.
Yep.
In their budget line item, it's nothing much, but it's a big amount to come this directly into, state food systems.
And it came from the Build Back Better initiative that was authorized by the American Rescue Plan.
Right. It was congressionally mandated.
Yes. And the purpose from that program was to maintain and improve food and agriculture supply chain resiliency within state and tribal governments to support local, regional, and underserved producers through the purchase of domestic local foods.
Right.
That is a fantastic objective coming out of the federal government.
Very, very complex. It starts with what we were talking about happened during the pandemic, where we realized we did not have the infrastructure, or the infrastructure we had was too long and too fragile. So this is the thing to be more locally resilient. And at the same time, it's basically giving money, buying quantities of food from farmers and then taking it either to food banks for free or schools too?
There's a side program that I believe is for early childhood education in schools. So that's a slightly different program than this one. But this one is focused on food banks, food pantries.
Right. So it's actually poverty program as well.
Yes.
It's a good social thing in addition to supporting the farmers to get a fair price for what they're growing. It then donates or gives for free the food to people who are in need.
Yes. So a wonderful program and a outstanding implementation. Talking about those food hubs and them figuring out how to implement this, I've just been impressed.
Farmers signed up and then getting the farmers paid and how much to pay the farmers. It's really a lot of moving pieces.
Yeah.
And it happened really fast.
Yes. It's over $1 million have gone for local food purchases. So to these socially underrepresented farmers, get priority. It's over 600 sites and over 200 or almost 200 producers.
Yeah.
So 200 farmers producing, going to at least 600 different places for people who need the food.
And multiple organizations in the state coordinating together. Yes. I think it was maybe PFI that nabbed that. Actually, I think Kayla Coder saw that funding and said, we got to apply. I mean, it was so much money, like several million dollars. Mm-hmm. We got to apply for this, even though it's only a 2-year, and now it's a 3-year.
I think it's,
It's a short-term shot in the arm, but I think it's an experiment. It started out as 2 years, and then they funded even for one more year to give it a good boost.
This is an example of a coalition. It took multiple different groups. Mm-hmm. It included the Meskwaki Nation to make sure they were included as well. It relied on some of that food hub knowledge that had been built and shared over time.
And the existing food pantries.
Yes, absolutely.
To have fresh produce at food pantries is not the same as them just picking up donated products that can sit on the shelf.
And it's been not only wonderful for those farmers getting paid a fair price and the folks who need it, especially with inflation and other pieces coming out of the pandemic, but it's been a wonderful example of what can happen with just a little bit of funding to kind of fill the gap.
To get it started. Yeah.
Yes. More farmers are connected with food hubs now. Food hubs, I think, have more nodes of distribution, to figure out how to make this work. Hopefully this program continues to be funded, but moving forward, there's just that many more connections and learning in that system.
Yeah. It's been kind of exciting to watch. When Kayla first told me about it, I looked at her and said, and how are you going to make this happen? It's a big deal. I mean, a great idea, but boy, what a lot of work.
And impressively
spreadsheets
implemented.
Galore. Whew.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it must affect students on campus, and heaven knows, maybe other people that work at campus too. The dollar does not stretch a lot, especially when you are going to school, and maybe you have a family at the same time.
So you do have a pantry on campus, right?
Yes. There is a pantry on campus. Very good.
We have a food pantry on campus, and we have a lot of need.
Yeah.
So as costs have gone up with tuition and inflation and a number of other things, what we find is it's harder for students to afford school, and they're probably doing it and scraping by more so than what they have in the past. And it means that if anything goes wrong for them, their car breaks down, that they need to get to a job, or an unexpected expense comes around, they have to decide, am I going to get food this week, or am I going to pay that bill? And kids, students at Iowa State, cannot learn if they are hungry.
Right.
You know, we know that all across the board. And so trying to provide enough assistance, I think there's still quite a bit of work to go, mm-hmm. but I'm happy that they're having that conversation at Iowa State. It's a larger conversation about, can students still afford to go to a land-grant institution? And we are not as accessible as we used to be, and we need to figure out other ways to improve that. But certainly in the meantime, making sure they're not hungry students on campus is really important.
Yeah, these are the young minds that we need to help feed us in the future. So yes. I often think of it. Also, are ramen noodles still a go-to for people? And what is the nutritional content of ramen noodles?
Well, I do believe students still eat ramen. I think ramen, peanut butter and jelly, pizza, and sandwiches probably make up a high portion.
And I bet ramen is at the bottom of the nutritional pile.
Well, it sure doesn't have much to recommend it, right?
No, it's just white flour, water, and some
And you get a lot of sodium if you use that packet.
And other flavorings,
yes.
Which are not always coming from food.
Yeah. Well, yeah. They had a start in food, but it got modified heavily before it got added.
Oh, goodness. Well, we've learned how to, we've changed our way of cooking. You mentioned we're busier. We don't, fewer people have gardens. Fewer people cook from scratch. There's something that, are meal kits still a thing? And how do people learn to cook?
Wow. Well, let me answer those two differently because I'm not sure they're the same. Certainly food.
They have been the same for some people.
Yeah. I believe it's possible.
I read about people who had to order meal kits during the pandemic because they didn't know what else to do. And then they learned to cook by following the instructions.
Yes. Yeah. So college kids learn via YouTube videos and TikTok. It is amazing how many food videos exist, and I think that is a highly popular place to learn. But it is amazing how many things you could learn in tutorials on YouTube.
Yes, but there's also no quality control there at all. Like Lana and I talk about, if you want to find a recipe, how it's much better to buy actually a cookbook than to look up something on the internet, because anybody can write a recipe. There's no testers. There's no repetition. They leave ingredients out. The instructions aren't clear.
It's not that I disagree with you, but that ship has sailed for Gen Z. They are not buying cookbooks, but at least a video watches how the food gets made, which is a step up from reading a recipe.
Well, I saw some things on TikTok. 1 minute where they like speed it up. They teach you a whole recipe in 1 minute.
Yep, that's patience level. That's the attention span. You're nailing that audience.
Well, but in terms of like food writing or, you know, what you would normally do to make a recipe book, that's why I looked at them, because I thought that's a really very intense skill set to be able to edit it down visually, verbally, bam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you can love it, you can hate it, but it is
it's pretty amazing.
Yep.
I mean, I recommend everybody watch one or two just to see what they look like.
And students know enough that if they see a video and don't understand what's happening, then they bring it to class and say, Kate, watch this. Tell us why that works or tell us why that doesn't work. We have some wonderful conversations around that area of things. Meal kits are pretty pricey for what you get, so I don't think it's a target audience for college age students.
No, actually, I think I saw a demo, either you said this or I saw it, that they're seeing that the targeted age for meal kits has turned out to be baby boomers.
Yeah, that's for ButcherBox for sure. I just learned about that.
ButcherBox?
So ButcherBox is essentially a frozen meat distribution, so you can order what you want. There might be kind of bundles that they are kind of recommending, but frozen meat will show up to your door. It's typically higher quality. So I was talking to ButcherBox folks when I was at the Nyman Ranch Hog Farmer Appreciation Dinner.
Oh, that's right.
A few weeks ago, but I was asking them all sorts of questions. Right, I was curious about how things changed through the pandemic or inflation and who's their normal customer. Because I would think that that's a convenience item to get frozen meat delivered to your door. And I think it is.
And are they delivering through like FedEx or something like that?
I assume so.
Something like that. Yeah.
I'm not quite sure. And what they said was, well, it's more baby boomers than you would expect. Well, yeah, that's not exactly what I would have expected. But if you think about younger generations.
Well, it's a little pricey.
Yeah, it's cost, but it's also, if you are a younger generation still in an apartment and you've got a small freezer, that's not going to make sense. Mm-hmm. Or if you are short on time, thawing meat fast enough to be ready for meal prep is not something you're always going to.
Okay, so this is basically the model of the Omaha Steak Company, right? Which has been going a long time.
I think so. It's a different mix of products.
But. Yeah. And also there is a local foods component to this. If you're not ordering for Butcher Block, which I believe is on the East Coast maybe or something, there are multiple services, or you can buy from a local farmer directly here in Ames and get bundles.
Yeah, yep, absolutely.
There's
a variety of different folks that are doing that, either through the Iowa Food Co-op or some CSAs have meat options.
Yeah, and also there's like Nick Wallace is doing the 99 counties thing. There's that, is it Flying Pig? I've forgotten. Flying Pig Farm? No, that's their logo. Farm Story Meats. Okay. Yeah, that's another one. They're happening.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we sold out dairy cows a few years ago because we didn't have anyone who was going to continue to pick up our meat. And the evolution of that has been my brother and sister-in-law raising out part dairy, part beef steers and selling meat. Mm-hmm. We already had pigs on the farm as well. So that's another their local distribution. And
yeah.
They're figuring out how far they can send it safely and still getting high-quality meat in the area.
Mm-hmm.
We have to kind of remember, as we're talking about the shipping things around, the burning of fossil fuels to get things from here to there. I mean, even in a local economy, we still have to get things from here to there and spend energy to keep it cold. But I think we could learn to use it more wisely and more judiciously, and as opposed to shipping things from heaven knows where. I don't know, from Argentina?
Right. I could get a pig from Kate's father and brother as opposed to, that's how I shop all the time. So yeah. I don't even know where other people are getting their food.
Yeah. But, you know, it's going to be difficult to get rid of the distribution aspect. But if you can reduce it. That's...
Well, we can't get rid of it. We just have to scale it to...
Yeah. Unless you're going to raise everything in your backyard.
Here, too. I want to mention again, this is KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. If you want to find out more about this fine radio station, go to www.khoifm.org, and you can find out more about our show. You can stream our show from that website, of course, and there's archives and recipes. Oh my goodness, we're so good. If you can't get enough of the Donna Lana Kitchen Show, you can do it that way. And we have a podcast.
Oh, we do. Wherever you listen to podcasts, you just put in Donna Lana, that's one word, DonnaLonna, second word, kitchen, and we will just pop right up there.
We are. We are.
Oh, and did we say that for Kate's food fair at ISU on the 20th of September, there will be an Onion Creek Farm booth with Lana's husband Joe selling his garlic bulbs, beautiful, fresh from the ground, and some of Lana's jellies. And I will be there kind of handing out information about the Donna Lana Kitchen.
So come and see. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about how we feed ourselves with Kate Gilbert.
So, Kate is from a farming family, and her parents, John Gilbert and Beverly Gilbert, are of the same generation as Lana and I, and Kate is now the second generation. Of course, you probably... four or five generations on that farm, right?
Yeah, we have to count back. There's quite a few there.
Yeah, but one thing that I am very aware of is the organic foods movement and the food sustainability began kind of in response to the post-World War II booming of the industrial food system. So there were a lot of people in my generation who were the first generation to, you know, eat Rice Krispie and Cocoa Puffs and stuff like that. And we grew up and said, whoa, wait a minute. Let's talk about the, you know, some values that maybe we're losing from, for example, the kinds of foods that my parents grew up and the things that my grandmother made and things like that. So we did a lot of, we established organic food standards. We kind of made a whole alternative food system that is the natural food system industry that has grown and grown and grown, which has, you know, become very interesting to the money makers because conventional food, like groceries and stores and stuff, the profitability for many years has been kind of, they're not losing money, but it's been flatlined in terms of growth, whereas the natural products sector has grown, you know, some years by double digits. So it's a big deal. But we are now into sort of the next generation of people, Katie's age, who are, I'm happy to say, are picking up the baton for, you know, things that Lana and people like Lana and I have been working on our whole lifetime. So tell us about what it feels like to be coming into this, especially having worked with your visionary parents.
Well, that's a big wind-up. I hope I can fill that. it's something that I reflect on a lot. I have peers who are coming into kind of this work without parents or farm background, and they bring a wonderful perspective as well. Mm-hmm. But much of my perspective has what I've learned over time. I think understanding history and progression of how things have changed is so valuable because if you don't understand the history, you're bound to repeat it. Right? So it's interesting that the movements that have happened and the skills that I've learned have made headway in some ways, but then the world changes at the same time. So it's somewhat the same story, but it's somewhat a different story. And so you take as many skills with you as possible to then adapt. But one of the things that my dad was key at was always being willing to try something new. So always looking at different ways to do something better, always looking at ways to be more resilient, more sustainable, use less inputs, find better ways to naturally raise livestock, any of those things. And so I learned from a young age that it was all right not to have all the answers, and it wasn't all right not to figure it out. And so I think that's a key piece that we will continue to need as we move forward. I would say my mom was pretty much the one that put her foot down and said, you have to make practical decisions. So that means...
How did your mother describe practical to you at a young age?
We can't afford that. You're not doing it.
Okay. Excellent.
Or, if you want to try that, you can do it on a small level to reduce the risk.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all sorts of ideas and knowledge that would be wonderful to implement quickly. But if you have to learn through those implementations, if there's a different level of risk or a different level of cost implementation.
And that, if there's an unknown oopsie in the middle of it.
That's risky. That's not a practical solution. So my mom was the one saying, that's nice that you want to try that, understand why, but you can do it at this level, or you need to wait until the cash flow allows it, that sort of thing. And so understanding how long change can take, because you have to be strategic, you have to be safe.
Well, that's a marvelous thing to know.
Yes, absolutely. And it's not always the most fun, but it is very
it's
important.
Daunting.
Yes.
Daunting, yeah.
And then the other piece that I would say that I think is so valuable as we move forward is understanding the value of networking and shared learning. Obviously, Practical Farmers of Iowa has probably done the best job I have seen at that. Not everybody can do every experiment on the farm, but if you can pool resources and everybody do a bit of testing and share, you can make it so much further down the road. And so I think that network is strong because of my parents' generation, your involvement.
Yeah, and your parents have been very involved in that. And they've also been, they signed on to the Nyman Ranch non-CAFO growing protocol, which we've talked about a lot.
Yeah. And, that's a perfect piece of understanding your environment, understanding how pigs are happiest, and understanding meat quality, and understanding how they all fit together.
Well, and that happy pigs are actually a management plus. You may have less, but the farmer experience is a lot better. The environmental experience is better. And the pigs themselves are happy, we subjectively assume.
Yeah, and that produces high quality meat. I mean, that's one of the
Which
reasons.
Which gets a premium price, so it makes it worth it.
That's one of the reasons I chose to study food science. I wanted to explain why the way we raised pigs the way we did indicated or produced a higher meat quality. And when you could explain the science along with the practice, that was a key moment to connect that information.
Thank you, Kate, for being with us today to encourage us to try new things, try practical things, and network. We have to share what we know because we all need food, and it's all better if we do it together.
There is a t-shirt that you can get at Ray Gun now, and 20% of the proceeds will go to the Iowa Farmers Union this month, and it's Monopolies Taste Terrible, Break Up Big Ag.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Kate Gilbert. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you Tuesdays at noon, and we come to you 7 p.m. in the evening on Tuesdays, repeated, or anytime at the KHOI website. Today we had music by the Barn Owl Band. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.